My name is John Christensen. I'm an economist and an accountant by background, an auditor, a forensic auditor. I've spent my entire career exploring the world of offshore tax havens. By way of background, I come from Jersey. I'm a Jerseyman, currently living near London in the Chiltern Hills. And I was the, until very recently, I was the director of the Tax Justice Network. I'm now director of the Balanced Economy Project, and I've retired, but I'm working on several major new projects, and I'm doing conservation work. So that's where things are at the moment, Tony.
Okay, could you tell us what you make of the latest? We've had various leaks. I mean, this is slightly different to what we've been used to from WikiLeaks, which have been, I would suggest, maybe more political. These independent journalists' leaks, things like the Panama Papers. There's also been leaks about China, for example, and now these latest Pandora Papers.
Yeah, well, I think leaks have become a feature of the modern world. With virtually everything now being digitized, it is exceedingly easy to download material or and spread it around. So, in terms of importance, I think the Pandora leaks are perhaps less revealing, or rather, they reveal stuff which had already been largely revealed. Yes, there's a new cast of personalities, but much of the kind of the systemic problems that come out of we can see from the Pandora Papers have already been explored in the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers. So there's a little bit of a sense of deja vu about this. But also a little bit of a concern that when people are reporting on this, the kind of it seems to be that there seems to be an assumption that if something's offshore, it's a bad thing. But we live in a globalized world of globalized financial movements, and inevitably there's going to be quite a lot of investment, and much of that investment is going to be routed through offshore financial centers. So I think one of the things that I'm kind of wary about is immediately assuming that anyone who's using an offshore structure is up to nefarious deeds. And I think that's been a bit of a concern in the last few days because it seems quite clear that some of the reporting is suggesting that people are doing bad things because they're using a BVI company or whatever. But that's not
Sorry, at
necessarily
what?
the case. A British Virgin Island company.
Oh,
So,
okay.
yeah. So I suppose in summary, yes, yet again, we find that a huge number of the world's elites are using offshore. Sometimes they might be using it for wealth management purposes, which basically means avoiding wealth taxes and avoiding inheritance taxes and maybe capital gains taxes. But we can't immediately assume that is the case.
Okay, so where did this all start? I think I remember back in the 1980s where a lot of people were celebrating where Margaret Thatcher and the City of London decided to get rid of exchange controls. Is that part of it, or is there more to it than that?
Oh, you know, the world of offshore tax havens goes back a long, long way. Amazingly, Switzerland was, even before Switzerland was a federated state, some of the cantons were handling money from other countries, and therefore, by the very fact that the money was coming out of France and going into banks in Geneva, Switzerland had developed itself as an offshore financial center, and indeed a tax haven. So it's got a long history. One thing's for certain, the deregulation of the 1980s, all a key part of Thatcherism, a key part of Reaganism, that accelerated the growth of the offshore financial world. And much of the growth at that time, I think we can be quite clear about this, was criminal. Much of it was involved money laundering, tax evading money, the anti-money laundering regulations were almost non-existent, compliance was almost non-existent, and it was a real Wild West economy. I think things have changed in recent years, but the truth of the matter is that capital went global, and capital put itself beyond the ability of nation states to effectively tax it and regulate it.
I mean, back in the 90s. This is enormously consequential, isn't it? Because it's meant that, you know, the biggest chunks of wealth, ordinary nation states are finding it extremely difficult to actually get their hands on it and to tax these people.
That's exactly the issue. Profits have been booked. Big companies have been booking their profits offshore for decades, making it extremely difficult for nation states to tax those profits. Wealthy people have been parking their money offshore for decades. The end result is that we've seen a steady shift in tax charges away from capital and onto labor and onto consumption. And anyone kind of wanting to explore the roots of inequality could well start by looking there, because as the tax charge has shifted away from income taxes, away from surtaxes, super taxes on profits, capital gains have, you know, they're taxed at a much lower rate now than they were in the 1970s. What's happened instead is VAT rates have gone up, national insurance charges, as you know, are going up, but they've gone up anyway. And we've seen a steady shift of the tax charge away from wealthy people and onto ordinary people. And I think that explains many of the economic problems that we currently have.
So where are the worst tax havens, and how many of them are British?
Right. Well, we often get asked where are the worst tax havens, and it comes as a surprise to most people to hear that actually the worst tax havens are in the United States and the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom is itself a tax haven, but the United Kingdom then has all these satellite havens of that work very closely with the City of London, and we can kind of identify them. There's Bermuda, there's the British Virgin Islands, there's the Channel Islands, there's Gibraltar, there's the Turks and Caicos Islands, there's of course Cayman. You know, these are all British territories, and although Britain tries to kind of use smoke and mirrors to pretend that Britain has no responsibility for these territories, there's no question about it. Britain has responsibility for these territories and just chooses to let them get on with their tax haven activity. So this is a political choice.
These countries will say, actually, we're self-governing.
Yeah, but that's not the case. It's just not the truth. No, that's just not true. I mean, as you know, I'm a Jerseyman. I was for 10 years economic advisor to the government of Jersey, and I headed the government economic service over there. It's just not true to say that these places are self-governing. But to begin with, every single law that is passed through the states of Jersey or the states of Guernsey or through the tin world in the Isle of Man has to be agreed and passed by the Queen's Privy Council before it can be ratified and put into law in the territories. And the same applies to the overseas territories, to Cayman, Bermuda, and so on. But also, if you look at the most senior officials in all of these territories, they are Crown appointments. And I know from my own experience of working in Jersey that very little happens there in terms of laws or regulations without having, at the very least, a nod from either the Treasury or the Home Office or the Ministry of Justice. So you know, there are very, very close links between Whitehall and these territories. The idea that they're totally self-governing and independent is a myth.
Okay, so what is the total amount of tax which would be paid, do you think? I realize this is going to be a very much estimated figure. How much money are governments, individual sovereign governments, losing by not being able to tax all this wealth? And do you know, I wonder, how much wealth is kept in these accounts in tax havens?
Yeah, let's begin with the latter, because it's you know, for obvious reasons, because of all the secrecy surrounding these offshore accounts and the offshore trusts and the offshore companies, we really don't have accurate figures for the amount of wealth that's held offshore and untaxed. There's a researcher in the United States, in New York, called Jim Henry, and I think his work in this is possibly the most accurate. And he, quite a few years ago, he put the figure of wealth held offshore untaxed, as it's held by private individuals offshore, largely through trusts and offshore shell companies. He puts it at somewhere around $36 trillion, which is a hell of a lot of money. As far as the tax losses are concerned, I mean, a lot of people think it's all about losing income tax or losing corporate income tax. It isn't. I mean, in many cases, the really wealthy people, the billionaires and the multimillionaires who are using offshore, are trying to avoid capital gains tax, inheritance taxes, wealth taxes across the board. Yes, they might well be avoiding some income tax and so on, but that's not the highest priority. At least certainly when I worked offshore, for quite a few years, employed by a company called Deloitte, that most of the clients were not actually that concerned about income tax. They could keep their income quite low. They were much more interested in avoiding capital gains taxes and wealth taxes. So, quite clearly, the sums of taxes being lost to governments across the world run to hundreds of billions of dollars every single year. Again, I've seen some estimates. I think they're very low side, in the region of 600 billion, but I think that's low side, because it's not really, we really don't have a clear figure of how much wealth is held offshore.
No, I mean, this is actually, there's a subtext to all of this, which is pretty shocking, really, because many of these billionaires, if they were to lose half of their wealth in tax, they would notice absolutely no difference whatsoever in their lifestyle at all. And in fact, even if 90% of their wealth was taken, they still wouldn't notice a difference in lifestyle. And yet those who are now paying the tax that they should be paying, in other words, the poor, are very often left in the situation where, for example, They have to go to food banks. They can't afford to feed their children.
Yeah, well, that's exactly the issue. And what we've seen, this is particularly since the era of Thatcherism and Reaganism, is that wealth has become extraordinarily concentrated in the hands of a tiny, tiny elite. I mean, at the time of the great financial crisis, the activists were talking about the 1%, but no, actually, wealth is very much more concentrated in the hands of the kind of 0.0001%, a handful of billionaires who control absolutely astonishing sums of wealth. And in most cases, that wealth is not earned by them being extraordinary capitalists or extraordinary entrepreneurs. They gain that wealth through having monopolies, through having concentrations of economic power, which means they can extract wealth from the rest of the world. And here is another problem which people might now need to start getting their heads around, which is that alongside the tax havens and the tax evasion and capital being so hard to tax these days, governments have allowed wealth and corporate power to become extraordinarily concentrated. And today everyone's talking about Facebook and the latest revelations about Facebook. But there you have a billionaire who's proud of the corporate power that Facebook has. Of course, it's a monopoly. Of course, they're extracting extraordinary sums of wealth. And of course, they're showing absolutely no corporate social responsibility whatsoever. But they seem to be beyond the power of governments to control them. That's the problem we face in the modern world, Tony. You know, this extraordinary concentration of corporate power is allowing companies like Facebook to extract wealth from the entire world.
Yeah, but the thing is, you're saying that governments have allowed this. Governments have got really no choice, because these people are just, it's almost like whack-a-mole. As they go for the money just disappears and pops up somewhere else in the world.
Well, I don't agree that governments have no choice. Actually, governments have had a choice for many, many years. For example, the British government has a competition policy. It has a competition authority, the competition market authority, and that authority really has done very little. In fact, you know, the City of London celebrates its involvement in mergers and acquisitions here in the UK across the rest of the world, and everyone seems to think that this is a really good thing. Look at all this money that's being invested in mergers and acquisitions. But actually, what's happening is these mergers and acquisitions are leading to very concentrated market power, and that's leading to wealth extraction. So actually, governments do have the power to take action. They just choose to not do that.
We've seen for example, recently with the demise of Morrisons being bought up by these hedge funds, another supermarket which is owned by hedge funds. It does seem as if we're getting into a situation where there's a handful of big investment funds, John, that are pretty much owning everything. So there isn't any real, you know, obviously, you know, for say Pepsi and Coke, both owned by Vanguard. There's these massive companies like BlackRock too that seem to own everything now.
Well, that's quite right. And again, you know, it seems to be unquestioned that either hedge funds or private equity funds are buying up absolutely everything. And no one's actually asking, well, is this a good thing? And the answer is absolutely not. It's not a very good thing at all. In fact, quite the opposite, because this financialization of the entire economy is simply accelerating the process of creating wealth extracting monopolies.
Can you just explain what you mean by that term financialization?
Yes, what I mean is that typically the private equity model is to buy a perfectly good company, and Morrisons is a perfectly good company. Of course, they're now private equity is now beginning to look at Sainsbury's and possibly even Tesco's. What they'll typically do is load the company with loads of debt. Very often that debt is sitting offshore. The company is then forced to pay huge amounts of interest to service this huge debt. Alongside that, they will typically cut staff costs. They'll cut back on investment in you know, real things, you know, in improving quality of service to customers. Cuts across the board in order to immediately boost profitability, which will boost the returns to the private equity people, but at the cost of lower wages, worse working conditions for employees, and probably higher prices in the long run for our consumers.
Okay, so let's get back to the Pandora Papers again. One of the things you said was that this information now is stored digitally and therefore it's more likely to be leaky. But surely, I mean, you know, we've got these Swiss banks have got a reputation for making sure that stuff doesn't leak. You know, if I was to try and hack into a Swiss bank, I'd find it extremely difficult. So is there maybe an element, do you think, of partiality in what's being leaked and what isn't? Because I noticed, I mean, at least in the coverage of this, that we've got quite a few, you know, celebrities, political celebrities like Blair, who I look at him and I wonder, well, maybe someone's realised that he's, you know, political value has dropped somewhat over the years, that, you know, maybe he's been ditched by the people that he's been, you know, the people he's been helping over the years. That there's a sort of lack of focus on the super powerful, the super wealthy, the funders of political parties, you know, the funders and the owners of vast amounts of wealth, like the arms industry, in the pharmaceutical industry, media, etc., to focus on celebrity rather than the real owners of our world.
Yes, but I wonder, Tony, whether that's more a reflection on the way that the big newspapers operate, and that I'd include the BBC and others in this, in that they tend to focus on celebrities. It's superficial, but they probably assume that audiences are going to be more interested in that. I don't think that they're really the media is really exploring the systemic problems here. And that's, these systemic problems include the way in which democracy has been undermined by the corruption at the highest level. And we have, you cited some examples of corruption, you know, the funding of political parties by offshore players, many of whom are, you know, who aren't resident in the countries where they're funding the political parties. The funding of politicians to do all sorts of political favors. Very often this funding is being routed through offshore financial centers and hidden behind shell companies and so on. So there's a vast amount of corruption that's gone on. And I think that's one of the biggest problems, which just isn't being explored by the media, which is that this secretive offshore world has turned the global economy into a criminogenic economy. That is where crime is so difficult to detect because it's hidden behind these offshore trusts and offshore shell companies that many people assume they'll get away with it. And sadly, in many cases, they do get away with it. Panama Papers led to a lot of investigations. Some people have been taken to court, but many people haven't been taken to court. And I suspect that will be the same here. Interest, you know, journalists will lose interest. No one else will investigate. I know that the Treasury have said they plan to investigate the Pandora Papers, but typically nothing ever happens. And that's not because there aren't any crimes revealed by this, but I suspect that the Treasury is really not particularly interested in this. And I suspect politicians aren't particularly interested in this. Let's face it, many of their friends and their funders are probably sitting there with their trousers round their ankles, knee deep in offshore monkey business.
Yeah, well, and also concerned maybe that their name might be in the newspapers in the next few weeks. But look, we interviewed a few years ago the former Sunday Times journalist, now turned author, Kevin Cahill, who's written various books, Who Owns Britain and Who Owns the World even, and his latest one, Who Owns Ireland. And he had managed to get a headline. In fact, he was telling us that he finished his shift on a Saturday, and then the next day he saw his headline on the front page of the Sunday Times, "The Rich Pay No Tax." This is back in the 1980s. Now, this has been going on and on and on. These people have been getting wealthier, wealthier and wealthier. Everyone throws up their hands and says, oh, well, there's nothing we can really do about this. And recently, Rishi Sunak and various other leaders of the financial world are saying we really do have to do something about it. Do you think anything can be done? Is anything realistically going to be done, John?
Oh, yes. I mean, lots of things have been done. I look back over the last 20 years and I think that, you know, there have been a number of successes and I've been involved in a few of those successes. So, Tony, we have automatic information exchange, and there's no question that automatic information exchange between tax authorities has led to a lowering of tax evasion. And that's a good thing. We're moving to an era where registries of companies will provide more information about company ownership, and that's also going to be a good thing. So there's plenty to be positive about. What concerns me, I think, particularly in Britain, is that our politicians really don't seem to get very exercised about this. I mean, where is the opposition? Why is the opposition not making a huge song and dance about this? Because that's their job, isn't it? Their job is to put pressure on the government to take action. And it seems to me that they're kind of falling asleep on the job here.
Surely it could be that they are actually benefiting from some of these wealthy individuals who got their money squirreled away in tax havens themselves.
Yep. I mean, there's always that possibility. And that, of course, is a scandal. I think that it's the role of the opposition to bring pressure on the government to take action. The government can do plenty of things. For example, Companies House, which is the UK Registry of Companies, is woefully inadequate. Everyone knows that the information stored there is inaccurate, out of date, in some case pure fraudulent. We don't have enough access to financial information very often. No accounts are being filed by companies. In other words, Companies House could do with a radical shake-up. The government should be doing this. It's for the opposition to put pressure on the government to take action.
Now, you're just retiring from the Tax Justice Network after 20-odd years of doing this, John. What do you think you've managed to achieve, and you and your colleagues in that period?
I think it was a really exciting ride. You know, Tony, when I started on this, many of the measures which I've already mentioned, for example, automatic information exchange between tax authorities or publicly accessible registry of company ownership, these things were, I was told, you know, 15, 20 years ago, this will never happen, at least not in your lifetime. And yet here they are. They are now becoming the global standards. We've seen country by country reporting by multinational companies adopted as the global standard. And that came out of the Tax Justice Network. But it was one of the first measures that we started to campaign around. And that has certainly improved the transparency. It's not yet where it needs to be, but this is a kind of long and iterative process. It takes a long time to, first of all, get the measures into place and then to refine them and strengthen them. But I think one of the most interesting things that's happened, and I think we can certainly take some credit for this, is that the United States, now you'll remember that earlier on I mentioned the United States as one of the worst culprits, with places like Delaware and Wyoming and Florida as, you know, as brazen tax havens as any of the tax havens in the Caribbean. The United States under Joe Biden is taking action, although I think that the minimum corporate income tax rate proposal is set at far too low a level. It was Biden who brought it forward. It sets a line in the sand at 15%, and that is a very important political signifier, because the US is saying we want to take action. And I think it's remarkable that the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, a very famous economist, former head of the Fed Reserve, is herself promoting this so strongly. And I think we can be reasonably optimistic that the tax justice agenda is live and well. My concern is that civil society is not bringing the same pressure to bear on our politicians as we were doing 15, 10 years ago. And I think that's a matter of concern, because I think it's the job of civil society to really bring the pressure on politicians to take action.
Well, you're being quite positive, you know, but if you look at what's been going on over the last 18 months or so with COVID, actually, the big tax evaders have done really well, or should I say avoiders, have done really well. You know, you're looking at your Amazons and people like this out of this, because more people are now, you know, sort of using their services. We're seeing smaller businesses going to the wall because they just haven't been able to make any money over the last 18 months, and the various government schemes either haven't worked for them or whatever. So those businesses have started, you know, folding, whereas the guys that have previously been doing so well out of keeping their money moving around the world and not getting taxed, the Amazons of this world, are very much on the up. In fact, you know, some people say even trebling their net worth.
Yeah, that's quite right. And it is a disaster. And that disaster is having social consequences. It's also having environmental consequences, because, you know, sadly, these are the people who use private jets and have gigantic gas-guzzling yachts moored down in the Mediterranean or wherever. The world simply cannot afford people, these kind of wealthy people who are, first of all, deeply antisocial, but also environmentally, you know, they're environmental catastrophe. But this is, again, this is a political failing, because it's been a political failure that we've allowed the Amazons and the Facebooks and the Googles and all these other monopolies in so many sectors to gain that market power that they can wipe out their opposition, extract wealth from the economy and become mega, mega rich without paying taxes and without paying their workers proper rates. And as you know, in the case of Facebook, without choosing to not properly regulate what's going on. There's plenty that can be done. But as I said earlier, I think this is ultimately to do with the political decisions around competition policy. And we now need to have a complete reversal away from the competition policy that was adopted coming through the Thatcher years and the Reagan years. And that competition policy can be summarized very, very quickly as long anything that leads to lower prices for consumers is okay, even if it leads to lower wages for workers, worse working conditions for workers, worse environmental outcomes, because big companies are able to do extraordinary damage to the environment and they get away with it. So I think we now need to have a complete shift of competition policy. We now need to demand that big companies, when they merge and they acquire other companies, they must demonstrate that it's in the public interest, not just lower prices, but better wages for workers, better environmental outcomes across the board. We now need to demand that companies, when they acquire other companies, and become these mega powerful things, we must demand that they demonstrate that it's in the public interest that they do this.
Well, we can demand all we want, but it does look as if the super rich and the super powerful have pretty much captured the policy of most of our main political parties. And as you said, the opposition seems to be rather silent on much of this. But, you know, whatever happens, and obviously there is a serious problem with wealth inequality, which is growing and growing all the time. You know, this is the basic reason we pay tax, is to make sure that that the infrastructure of the nation is there, and also that those who are really on the line of destitution are kept from falling through the cracks. But as this gets worse, then there is some sort of light on the horizon, supposedly, from people like Prince Charles and Klaus Schwab at the World Economic Forum. They're calling it the Great Reset. I wonder if you've had a look at it and what you make of it, John.
Yeah, I have had a look at it, and the fine words. You know, the rhetoric is great, and you know, listen to the Prime Minister talking today, and you know, he's all about resetting the economy and so on. But I think the actions are, well, we see very little in the way of real action, and very little understanding of how harmful tax havens are, and therefore why it must be a priority to take action against these tax havens. Behind the rhetoric, I don't see either Prince Charles or Schwab, or indeed the Prime Minister, wanting to take radical action to restore the ability to tax capital, that is, to tax capital gains, to tax wealth, to tax to restore inheritance tax to a meaningful tax, or indeed to take really strong action to strengthen the working conditions of workers across the world. I just don't see it happening. So great rhetoric, where's the action?
Well, what they're saying is really there has to be some kind of a world government, a kind of global coming together of nations to sort this out.
Well, certainly in the case of tax havens, there are two global entities. Well, not global. There are two multilateral agencies. One is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The other is the United Nations. But the United Nations, it doesn't have the capability or indeed the capacity to work effectively in this. Most of the running has been made by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The truth of the matter is that as long as you have very powerful countries like United Kingdom, Ireland, United States, and the Netherlands blocking progress, which they have been doing for a very long time, we're not going to get very far.
Okay, John. Well, look, that's a bit of a shame. It'd be nice to be able to leave Tax Justice Network with the something a little bit more positive to say, because my sense is that by not taxing these people, they're using their reserve wealth for enormous political lobbying, media lobbying, etc. And it's going to be an uphill battle and struggle in order to get some of that $36 trillion or whatever it is off of them. But whereabouts do you think people can go to follow online, particularly? I mean, I don't imagine the Financial Times is the best source for this, but in order to follow what's going on around the world in tax justice, and it also, of course, this means wealth inequality, to follow what's happening with it.
Yeah, good question. By the way, I'm much more optimistic than perhaps my last my last comments suggested. I actually think that the Biden administration in particular recognizes that particularly after what happened in the attacks on the Senate in January, that democracy is now threatened by this extraordinary inequality, and they're going to have to take action. So I think we're reaching that point where we might actually start seeing some political action, but it's not going to come from the UK, sadly, at least not with the current government. But look, I've always read the FT. The Financial Times is a really interesting source of information, partly because it's so interested in capitalism. And it really, it looks at the underlying stuff. So I've read the FT since I was 18 years old and found it very useful. But look, I'm also involved in a really interesting project called the Balanced Economy Project. And if you look for it online, you'll find that my colleague, Nicholas Shackson, the journalist, the author of the Finance Curse book, but also of Treasure Islands, one of the best exploration of tax havens. Nick is producing a bi-weekly newsletter called The Counterbalance, and you can subscribe to that because I think that's really interesting. And of course, I'm still working with Naomi Fowler, who's the producer of the excellent Tax Cast. It's always excellent. That comes out monthly. It's available free of charge. So you can download and listen to the Tax Cast. And for international listeners, there's also a French version, a Spanish language version, an Arabic version. So it's available in several languages. And that is a really excellent exploration of the kind of the big picture issues.
OK, John Christensen, have a happy retirement. And thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. Cheers. All the best.
All right. Thanks, John. Have you got a website, by the way, for that? What was it called again?
The Balanced Economy Project.
Yeah.
Just look for the Counterbalance newsletter, because that's available from one of these special feed services. So it'll feed through automatically every time it comes around. So that's the best way, I think, of getting hold of the Counterbalance. And whilst I'm retiring from Tax Justice Network, I'm still staying pretty damned active on the Balanced Economy Project. I'm working with Richard Murphy on the Corporate Accountability Network. We're going to work up some new measures for strengthening corporate transparency on their tax measures. And I'm doing a whole load of work in the conservation world as well. So it's going to be a pretty busy retirement.
Okay, well, just looking at that website, it's The Counterbalance, one word, thecounterbalance.substack.com.
That's the one.
Okay, John, thanks very much for joining us.
Cheers, Tony.